that I am really excited to start to be getting to know. And I, God willing, I look forward to, you know, many more dinners and more time spent with them. But Bill Parkinson, that's not me looking for an invite right now, it's okay. Bill Parkinson grew up here in the South Bay and has attended Branch of Hope, this meeting house, this body of believers, for about 30 years. Yeah, yeah. And he doesn't look it. So, anyway, what you need to know is, remember, I said earlier, people contributed to the writing of their own bio. So you're going to get a sense of Bill's humor in just a second. You know, trigger warning. He has a Bachelor's of Science degree in biology from the University of California, Irvine, which his sister likes to remind him makes him the least educated person in his family. I did not write that. I read what I'm given. He commutes from Redondo Beach to Newport Beach every day and listens to lots of podcasts that have given him a wealth of mostly useless knowledge. Now that's something he and I share. He enjoys discussing matters of science, philosophy, theology, and apologetics, and has followed the intelligent design movement for several years, probably even back when it was known as creation science. Remember those days, folks? He and his wife, Pam, have been married for 26 years, and they have 3 children, Katie, Emma, and Dylan. Some of this family is here. We would obviously love to have had all of them with us. They're a wonderful family. They are so hospitable. They treat me well, which tells you everything you need to know. I can be a tough character if you might, you know, get along with and so forth. But anyway, with no more preamble, let's bring up Bill.
Hey, everyone. So I would add least educated among the speakers by far, which will probably be evident from my presentation. This is basically it. It's all memes, my presentation. I don't know if you can read that. This is a picture my wife sent me when she heard I was doing this talk. Can you read it? It says, it's a wolf there. He says, I'm cold and hungry. Wait. Get my glasses on. What does that say? I'm cold and hungry. I see humans around a bonfire. Maybe I can ask for food. What could possibly go wrong 3,000 years later? You see the effects of that. So I think that is the poster child for the anti-intelligent design movement. I should know, believe me. So my talk is intelligent design, biblical, scientific, or both. I had the pleasure of meeting Stephen Meyer, who's one of the leading figures of the intelligent design. Actually, Bob Prook and I were there and at a Ligonier's conference, and he's just like, it's funny, he was just sitting there at a table all by himself, just schlepping his little book, and now he's a major figure and really got me excited about this discussion and the theory of intelligent design. I'm no expert. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a philosopher. But what I hope I can do maybe today is give you a sense of the types of arguments and theories that this movement is proposing and give you some education that'll help you make the determination of whether it's biblical, scientific, or perhaps both. There we go. Okay, I'll get the hang of it. Okay, so, design arguments have been around forever, all going back to ancient history. And in the 19th century, the arguments from design were mostly impressed and concerned with adaptation. You see these cheetahs here, they're the way their bone structure is, their muscular structure, all the way down to, these little black lines under their eyes, kind of like you see athletes to shave their eyes. This bug right here has something on its back that looks like a thorny ant. You can see this mountain goat here and the way it clings to cliffs. And people looked at the natural order, everything seemed designed and customized for its habitat, adapted for exactly where it was supposed to be. And people were very impressed by this. Darwin came along and he basically said, well, I've got another idea here. And he said, he used as an example, most people are aware he had the, he used finch beaks and the different, you've heard of Darwin's finches. He used an example about a shepherd with a flock of sheep. And he basically said, we know from selective breeding that a shepherd can basically, if he wants a woolier sheep, that what he can do is he can go to his flock and what does he do? He picks out the sheep that are the wooliest, he breeds those together, and if he keeps doing that over and over and over again, what will he have? He'll have a group of sheep that has a heavier wool. They're woolier than the rest of the sheep. So what Darwin said is, what if instead of a shepherd or a breeder doing that, what if you just had a series of very cold winters? And if you had those very cold winters, then what would happen? It would be the exact same thing. I mean, you would, over successive years, what would happen? The woolier sheep would tend to survive those winters, and lo and behold, you'd have the same effect after several generations. You'd have a woolier group of sheep. And so he basically said, look, there is design, we see design in the natural world, but it's really a perceived design. It's not a design that was put there by a designer. And so William Paley, who had written his Natural Theology in 1802, had used this example of finding a watch in a field and being able to intuit just from the various working parts and that it was designed for a purpose. And if it was designed for a purpose, then clearly there must have been a designing intelligence. What Darwin said is, the old argument of design in nature as given by Paley, which formerly seemed to me so conclusive, fails now that the law of natural selection has been discovered. There seems to be no more design in the variability of organic beings and in the action of natural selection than in the course of the wind blows. So the idea is the natural selection acting on variability was the cause of all the apparent design. And this was a very satisfying solution to a world at a time of the Enlightenment, a philosophical situation where people were looking for an excuse to jettison God from the equation. And Darwin comes along and says, look, you don't need God. Everything we see, all the differences that we see, all this adaptation is just the result of natural forces acting on random variations. And you've seen this quote, Richard Dawkins. He summed it up by saying, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. It's only the appearance, though. There is no designer. There is no purpose. So that was kind of the going theory and was very popular and accepted and seemed to answer a lot of questions until 1953, when Watson and Crick first elucidated the structure of the DNA molecule. And more importantly, in 1958, Francis Crick, I'm getting these buttons mixed up, this guy right here, he was a code breaker in World War II, and he actually proposed the sequence hypothesis. And this is probably arguably one of the greatest breakthroughs in the history of science. This discovery that within the DNA molecule, there is these base pairs that are inside the molecule are functioning like an alphabetic code. And what I mean by that is it is nothing about the chemical or physical properties of the base pairs themselves. It is their sequence in the molecule that produces an effect. For the first time, we had discovered information in nature. And that is when the current structure or the current form of the intelligent design theory took form. And it's summarized here. There are methods of intelligent detection other than adaptation. Certain patterns in nature exhibit features which in any other circumstance we would attribute to intelligence. The information-rich structures of biological systems are best explained by a designing intelligence, not by an undirected natural process such as natural selection acting on random variation. Living systems look designed because they are designed. Okay, so what I want to draw your attention to is this phrase right here, which in any other circumstance we would attribute to intelligence. We are seeing something that if we were not looking inside a natural system, if we saw this situation in a different circumstance, we would think there was a mind there. And I'm going to give you an example, ironically, from a movie, my favorite thing to talk about, the movie Contact. Carl Sagan, this guy right here, huge, did not like intelligent design at all, wrote a book in 1985 called Contact. It was about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence project put on by the government. It's called the SETI program. And basically, that's where they are pointing these satellites out into the universe looking for signs of intelligence. It's a real thing, and it's operating right now, today. Jodie Foster is the scientist. She's a big atheist. She was kicked out of Sunday school for asking who Cain's wife was. Matthew McConaughey, he's like the spiritual advisor to the president, and he's a total, he's like channeling his Lincoln commercials that he does today in this role. Tom Skerritt here. He's the guy who gets to go see the aliens. Why? Because he believes in God. Jodie Foster doesn't get to go because she doesn't believe in God. That's until this guy, who's a big religious zealot, straps a bomb to himself and blows up Tom Skerritt when he's going to see the aliens. So Jodie Foster here, the atheist, gets to go see the aliens. I just mentioned that to say there was a total agenda in this movie. I really liked it, but basically, all the people that believed in God here were total losers. but anyways, my question is, what was the signal that came from outer space that Jodie Foster and her team of researchers interpreted as coming from an intelligent source? Does anybody remember? Okay. This was it right here. Isn't that obviously an intelligent design source? this is the way it arrived, and it arrived in a series of pulses. Okay, the ones in that sequence represent a pulse; the zeros represent a pause. And they listened to this for literally about 3 seconds, and they instantly knew that it was from an intelligent source. Now I'm going to show it to you in a different format, and the math guys in here will quickly understand how they deduced it. What's that? Primes. Good. Who is that? Farney? Oh, Don. You already saw this presentation, Don. Yeah, it's a list of all the prime numbers from 2 to 101. Now, the question is, why? We know that. Like, if I saw that, I would know that was from an intelligent source. But the question is, why? Why did they know it came from an intelligence? How do they know that it wasn't just a random radio signal? I mean, there's radio signals going on all the time in space. That's what they're listening to. For the most part, it's all gibberish. But then they saw this, and they immediately interpreted it as design. Now, I'm asking that question as if we don't know, but it's obvious what it is. But there is a way to analyze this for its information content. And people who study intelligent design ask these basic questions. They say, is the thing I'm observing contingent or necessary? So is there anything about radio transmissions that would make them show up in the form of prime numbers? They ask themselves that. We know intuitively, and especially these researchers knew, no, there's nothing about that. Complex versus simple. Was it sufficiently complex such that it could not reasonably be produced by repetition? Okay, so if they got a signal from space and it just went boop, boop, they wouldn't call the president and say, hey, we found an alien, he sent us a prime number. Like, that's not how it works. It has to be sufficiently complex. But that's not enough, because you can witness complex situations, and on their own, they will not, they do not indicate intelligence. You can shuffle a deck of cards and deal it out, and that sequence of cards that you've shuffled, that's probably the first time that deck of cards has been in that sequence ever in the history of mankind ever. All the card decks that have ever been dealt, you're looking at a totally original, totally complex sequence. But that's not intelligent design. I just shuffled the deck. Now, what makes it intelligent is that the sequence is specified. And what that means is there is an independent pattern, something unrelated to the thing itself that it codes for or that it represents. And in this case, the signal, it was complex and it represented the sequence of prime numbers. Now, they did all that kind of math quickly in their head. Now, it turns out that we do this all the time, okay? And I've got a couple examples of that. What's that? Mount Rushmore. Did that happen through just erosion and weathering? No. How do we know? Well, we know because we know there's nothing about weathering and erosion patterns that would cause that thing. We know that it's complex and it's not simple, and it represents something. What does it represent? It represents those four presidents. Let's look at another one. Grand Canyon. Is that product of intelligent design? No, right? It's complex, but what test does it fail? It fails the necessity test. I mean, we can show by observation and experiment that this is what weathering and erosion does. But if I get to the Hoover Dam, now what do I say? That is intelligent design. Okay, we do this all the time. What is this? Is this a driveway with pavers in it? Devil's Postpile in Mammoth. So what test did that fail? Again, that failed the necessity test. It kind of looked intricate. It looked design. We don't tend to see things like this every day in nature. That's what makes that thing kind of cool. But when scientists study this, they learn that when, you know, these materials that are at a high temperature and they settle and then they melt, that they typically form these patterns, and that's what caused the Devil's Postpile. Okay, I got a couple more. Stonehenge. Okay, my point is that these different disciplines use these techniques to detect intelligence all the time. Okay. Did those rocks just get there? Was there a flood? Was there an avalanche? Were they set there? How were they set there? Why do we think they were set there? We put it through the same tiers. What about this one? Any of you speak Chinese? Some of you might. You've never seen this before, but you can look at it and you can tell what's going on here. This is a sidewalk in China where they've basically put some paint that says, hey, if you're using your cell phone, we don't want you to bump into each other, so you know, you go this way, you go that way. We don't think somebody just spilled paint on the ground. Okay? It's complex, and it refers to something other than, outside of itself. This is a good one. This is Robert De Niro. It's in the movie Casino. And his pit boss just allowed three jackpots to hit in a row and didn't basically grab the guy and throw him in the back room and beat him up. And Robert De Niro is coming out here yelling at him. He's saying the probability of hitting one of those machines is 1.5 to 1. The probability of three of them hitting is billions. It cannot happen, would not happen. He's using intelligent design, okay? It doesn't have to happen. It's very complex and unlikely. And it's specified for something. What does it specify for? Paying the guy who did it, who rigged the slot machines, you know, all kinds of money. He knows instantly it's intelligently designed. Ooh, what about this guy? Anybody remember who this guy is? Okay. What movie is this from? Very good. Hunt for Red October. What was he doing? Hunt for Red October. They were looking for a submarine that was so quiet that its motor gave off a signature that would normally sound like seismic activity, natural activity. What did he do? He slowed it down, he mixed it, he reprocessed it, and he played it for the captain. He said, this is obviously man-made. So the point is that this process, this science of intelligent design occurs all the time. It occurs in forensics, it occurs in archaeology, it occurs in cryptography, and the SETI program. Remember, the SETI program, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, it's not looking, they don't think they're going to see a little green man. That's not what they're looking for. They're looking for the effect. They're looking for the signature of intelligence. I'm going to advance my slides here to catch up with where we're at. So, William Dembski has put together this thing called the explanatory filter. And basically, this is just a flow chart which allows us to analyze data, analyze evidence, and see if it passes this design test. And you can start from the top, and you ask yourself, is it contingent? Okay? No? Then the thing we're looking at is just operating out of necessity. Not it fails, not intelligent design. Is it sufficiently complex? No? Then it's just subject to chance. Is it specified? Not specified, chance. If it is specified, it's design. If it passes these three tests, we can conclude that there is intelligent design. So let's go back to the DNA molecule. I tried to find the very simplest. I have no complicated slides. This is a DNA molecule. Eddie spoke a lot about it. And this part right here are these bases, these sequences that code for the proteins in your cell. This, your DNA, if you were to take one, all the DNA that you have in one cell and stretch it out, it would be about 6 feet long, one cell. If you took all the DNA in your body and you stretched it end to end, it would go across our entire solar system and back. 10 billion miles of DNA is the estimate of how much you have in your bodies right now. It's unfathomable. If we expanded the DNA to the thickness of a fishing line, it would be about 800 to 1,000 miles long. Okay, and each millimeter of that would represent kind of a byte of information. My point is, it's incredibly long and complex. Just picture 800 to 1,000 miles of fishing line sitting on this stage right now, what that would look like. And every cell in your system, in every cell in your body has that in the nucleus with all those bytes of information. And not only that, but a machinery that allows the cell to replicate that and translate that at unbelievable speeds and accuracy. Eddie used these very large numbers to give you an idea of how complex and how big the problem is. What I would like you to focus on is this right here, is in addition to that complexity, is this coding function. These right here represent amino acids here. There is no relationship, physically, chemically, otherwise, between these things. They don't cause, they don't react with the amino acids in a way that causes them to link together here in the nucleus. What happens is the DNA strand right here is copied into a strand of RNA that goes outside of the nucleus, and this big thing right here, this ribosome, basically is like a clamp that clamps over the RNA molecule, and it kind of hops along that molecule, and it grabs amino acids from the cell and links them up together. And it does so at a rate of about six of these amino acids every second. This process right here, this translation process, 30 codes per second, 30 of these per second are translated into messenger RNA. I mean, if you go on YouTube and you see the animations of this process, which they're able to do through, I mean, these things are so small, they're below the wavelength of light. You literally can't see them because light does this, and they're like in the middle of that wavelength. You can't light them up. So you gotta use very special techniques, X-ray techniques and things like that. But they've elucidated this whole process, and it's unbelievable. But importantly, it represents a coding function. And what the intelligent design folks are saying is, we have no example in the natural world for a coding function, for the creation of information other than intelligence, other than mind. Okay, so if we look inside living things that we manifestly did not create and had nothing to do with, then the conclusion is, if I know that no natural process can account for those, then a designing mind must account for that. It actually doesn't make any claims as to who that designing mind is. It's not really interested in going there. It's actually plausible within the confines of the intelligent design theory for us to be seeded here by aliens. And frankly, that's what some evolution folks have, posited. Francis Crick to being one of them. And Dawkins even said it at one point, if you watch that Expelled movie with Ben Stein. But anyways, my point is, there's a very strong case to be made that what we are seeing here represents information. And the question is, can Darwinists demonstrate that this type of information can be generated naturally or through natural causes? Next slide. This I put in here just because I thought it was cool that I could put a GIF inside a PowerPoint slide. But this is an example of the protein products that are made when those amino acids are put together. Okay, this thing is called ATP synthase. This is a mini motor that is inside the mitochondria, which is inside your cell. If you think of your cell, the cell has little batteries inside it that power it. Those batteries are called mitochondria. And in that mitochondria is this motor right here. Okay? The proteins, like Eddie said, when they're first made, these represent different proteins. When they're first made, they just come out as strings of like beads. Just picture them that way. And then what they do is, because of the specific sequence of those beads, now I'm not talking about the sequence of DNA right now, the sequence of the amino acids and their attraction to each other, they fold and they form in a very specific way. Okay, these things work because of their physical structure and shape. You have to understand that. This thing right here, this blue thing, it has a little knob on it that acts like a camshaft. Are you familiar with a camshaft in a motor? That's like a little bump, and when it turns, it lifts something. That doesn't work. This whole thing doesn't work unless that bump's there. This little thing right here, this is a motor. The way that this motor runs is hydrogen protons coming in on this side and attaching here and then being popped in on this side. The only reason that that happens is because there's a whole other proton pump somewhere else in the mitochondria that's basically maintaining a gradient on both sides of the cell. It's kind of putting a lot of protons here so that they want to flow this way. Then it puts a little motor here that gets powered by those protons. And what happens is, every time this camshaft bumps this protein, the actual structure of that protein changes, and it puts two molecules together which form a packet of energy. So why is this important? Well, for one, it's an example of like what Eddie said, this irreducible complexity. The idea that this thing does not work if any of the component parts are not there. And so it is very difficult, if not impossible, to come up with a Darwinian explanation for how several separate parts can come together in a functional whole. That's called direct Darwinian evolution. So these molecules, when they're separate, they don't say to themselves, hey, let's form a motor. Like they have no inclination towards each other, nothing. So they can't see the motor ahead and say, hey, if we group together, that would be nice. That does not happen in chemistry. Okay, so there's no direct Darwinian pathway. Now, if you look up irreducible complexity online, the first YouTube videos you'll see, it's everybody just saying, oh, you know, we've totally debunked irreducible complexity, and Michael Behe's a joke, and, you know, like, really, don't believe him. All they've done is they have found a kind of a subset of this system somewhere else, and they basically have said, hey, like, here's kind of a step. It's like the chihuahua to the horse. Here's a step along the way. It's the equivalent of saying, hey, I found a fuel pump. That explains the whole car. Like, there's no explanation. There's no pathway that's been given, and everybody knows it. They might not say it, but they know it. Now, so the significance of this is another type of intelligence detection, right? I mean, I've got the information intelligence detection, but then I've got the bringing things together to form a functional whole. And that's what we call irreducible complexity. This is something that Darwin said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down, but I can find no such case. Okay, so he admitted the Darwinian model works only if you can have gradual, successive steps in the process, and every step in the process has to create a functional advantage. You follow that? Like, you have to demonstrate how the different parts can come together, and at each step along the way, that gives the organism some advantage. And so if we find structures that cannot be explained that way, it's very difficult for the Darwinian model. Now, somebody asked me when I was preparing for this talk, and they just said, you know what? It just seems like everything I hear is that every day we're finding more and more reasons to believe in Darwin. We're finding more bones. We're finding more this. All the research is... You have to understand that is not the case, okay? That is not the case. This 2016 Royal Society of London meeting, this guy, Gerd Müller, head of the Department of Theoretical Biology at the University of Vienna, his opening remarks to this conference is like 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. The explanatory deficits of the modern synthesis. When people say the modern synthesis, they're talking about Darwinian evolution or neo-Darwinian evolution. Okay, you've noticed that should be a clue right there, modern synthesis. They're calling it something else. They don't like the current theory. They don't like it. They're already starting to change the name. Okay, what are the problems that he says? The origin of phenotypic complexity. That's basically the origin of the physical, you know, creatures that we see in nature, the complexity of living things. The origin of anatomical novelty, that's basically the different body forms that we see. How did those come about? And the origin of non-gradual modes of transition. In other words, the fact that we seem to see things happening not gradually, but kind of instantaneously when we look in the fossil record. So I don't know if you can tell, but that's all of Darwinism. That he's saying that basically Darwinian evolution does not explain all the things that it said it was supposed to explain. This is not a group like us, like getting together and like, you know, we hate Darwin. These are the guys that are supposed to believe in this stuff, and they see major problems with it. Okay. You see me fiddling with my computer. It is, like, not advancing, so it's causing me problems. But I'll just keep going. Oh, this guy is so great. I put that little title there, Assassin. James Tour, this guy is, Christian, the intelligent design folks, they get a lot of grief for not being scientists. You can reach a level of expertise where they just can't mess with you anymore, and that's this guy. He's 650 research publications, 120 patents. I mean, this guy's laboratory is doing stuff that means big money to big companies, and he's doing revolutionary work in the field of chemistry. Named one of the 50 most influential scientists in the world today. Winner of the first ever nanocar race. I was telling Julie about this when I was preparing. There's a nanocar race, a competition just a couple years ago. You can fit, these nanocars are made out of individual molecules. They're actual automobiles. They're powered by light. They have motors, they have axles, they have wheels. You can fit 50,000 of them on the width of a human hair. Okay, it's unbelievable. And they had a race over 100 nanometers. This guy's car is so much better that he actually got a 50 nanometer. He had to start 50 nanometers behind the other cars because he's been doing this for so long. And he had to race on silver instead of a gold plate because silver's bumpier. Anyways, he still won. His lab still won. You have to go online at some point and watch his YouTube video. He just savages chemical evolution. He recently basically made a call to end all experiments about the kind of primordial soup about life from nothing. He said, we shouldn't be doing this anymore. We know it's impossible. And nobody's given him any satisfactory answers. This guy is awesome. And he's a Christian. So is it science? Well, I think we've covered some of this in the previous talks, and hopefully some of the remarks I made initially in terms of just the practice of detecting intelligence is a recognized scientific endeavor. Just to go through it, it's based on empirical evidence. It's based on what we see. We're making deductions on what we see, and we're looking for causes now in effect that create the thing that we're seeing. And the causes now in effect are what? Intelligence. Uses established scientific methods. What Jason was saying in terms of, the different kinds of science and the historical sciences and how they operate and how they look at effects and try to deduce causes. It uses all those types of methods. It's testable. It's being tested every day, believe me, because its primary contention is that natural processes can't create information or specify complexity. What do you think every Darwin scientist is trying to do right now? It's being tested all the time. Conforms to established methods of inquiry in the historical sciences, I said that, addresses a specific question in evolutionary biology, and namely the appearance of design. The only reason that people even ask this question or pose this question is because they are committed to something called scientific materialism or methodological naturalism. And basically it says you cannot posit a solution that is not purely natural. Now, they've just come up with that definition. I mean, that has not always been the case. Here are some intelligent design, and I put the quotes there, scientist. Johann Kepler, explained, the motion of the planets. Isaac Newton, gravity, motion, pretty big stuff, pretty big, theories. Robert Boyle, father of modern chemistry, author of The Scientific Method. This guy, Fred Hoyle, I don't know if you know who that is. I'll tell you about him in a minute. My point in naming these guys all believed in a creative intelligence when they were doing their scientific experiments and their theories. None of the modern day Darwinian would ever say that these guys were not doing science. Now, what they would say is that, they just didn't know. They just didn't have the information. They were living in a world where everybody believed in God or whatever. Okay, fine. But if they went back, if they went back in time in a time machine into Isaac Newton's lab and looked at what he was doing, they wouldn't disqualify him as a scientist just because he believed in a designing intelligence. I mean, all due respect to Dawkins and, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson and Michael Shermer and all those guys, he would crush them. I mean, they're it's amateur hour compared to those guys. And so, you know, just the idea that if you have a scientific endeavor that includes the idea of a supernatural or a metaphysical cause to things should by no means disqualify it as science. This guy, Fred Hoyle, this is a good story. Does anybody know who Fred Hoyle is, like what he's known for? So he coined the term the Big Bang, okay? So, but what's funny is he did it as kind of a pejorative. He was kind of, in a way, making fun of it when he said it, because he was a steady, he also created the theory of the steady state universe theory, which basically said the universe had been in the same state forever. So when somebody, when they started to devise this idea of a Big Bang, which had a starting point, right? That was the idea, instead of just being around forever, he was kind of like, okay, come on, really? Big Bang, like everything blew up. But what ended up happening is the more he looked at it, the more he looked at the evidence, the more he studied it, he became convinced not only of a starting point, but he got right on board with the he is an intelligent design advocate, okay? And he basically said, like, nobody can look at the operation of the heavenly bodies, what's called the fine-tuning of the universe for life, and not conclude that some super intelligence, some super deity has been kind of, you know, organizing the laws of physics. Here's another guy. Another point I want to make here is, like, we've been down this road before. This is what you have to understand. We've reached scientific conclusions that have had implications that the scientific world doesn't like. Einstein, he came up with the idea of a start to the universe on his own with his calculations. His theories had led him to conclude that the universe might have had to have a starting point. He didn't like that. Okay? He didn't like that, because when you say the universe has a starting point, you start raising all these questions about, like, okay, where did it come from? And what he did is he just created out of nothing this constant that would balance out, that if you put it in the equation, that would balance out his theory so that it didn't need a starting point. He just made it up. And he later called it the biggest mistake of his life. So, And he abandoned it, because he realized, he actually looked through a telescope, Hubble's telescope, and Hubble showed him the expanding universe, and you know, and basically it became obvious that if the universe is expanding, if you go back in time, it must have started from a starting point. And Einstein admitted, he says, I now see that the universe had a beginning. Now, it doesn't matter whether, you know, we're in here and you think the universe is 13.8 billion years old or 6,000, 8,000 years old. That's not what I'm talking about. All I'm saying is this is a great example of the modern scientist coming across a discovery that does not fit their paradigm, fighting it, and eventually, in this case, relinquishing it. Every modern scientist believes that the universe had a starting point. Now, they don't necessarily believe in God, and they come up with other justifications for it. But I believe we are at the same point with Darwinism. I mean, I've been saying, I wish I could have shorted Darwinism, like, 20 years ago or whatever. You know, I mean, it has so many challenges, and we have the opportunity right now, I think, to see the classic version of neo-Darwinism. It's going to go away in our lifetimes. I don't know what's going to be replaced with, but it will go away. Here's a Stephen Meyer quote I like. This is at the end of his signature in the Cell book. If living things bear the hallmarks of design, if they exhibit a signature that would lead us to recognize intelligent activity in any other realm of experience, then perhaps it is time to rehabilitate this lost way of knowing and rekindle our wonder in the intelligibility and design of nature that first inspired the scientific revolution. I think that's a good quote. And basically what these guys are calling for is like, look, they're not calling for an end, frankly, to studies of natural selection. They're very, very valuable. When we study the activity of diseases and their ability to develop resistance to certain treatments, those things happen. Natural selection happens. What it doesn't do is create everything that we're looking at today. Is it biblical? Well, you should know that before getting too excited about it, I want you to know kind of what you're getting into. Like I said, it's very agnostic to who the designing intelligence is. If you follow these people, they're not trying to make any claims about who God is. There's a lot of Christians, a lot of believers in the movement, but not necessarily all of them. A lot of them are people who really are just dissatisfied with the current model and believe the current argumentation, but really haven't come to any conclusions about who the designer is or what it might be. Includes many old Earth universe proponents. A lot of these guys believe in an old Earth. I don't know where you're at on that, but there's a big variety of thinkers within the movement. Includes many common descent proponents. You need to understand that even though intelligent design suggests there had to be something at the start, something to design the process, there's a lot of people within the movement who believe that nevertheless, a lot of what we see today are in terms of living creatures are related to each other and the product of some kind of macro evolution. But I will say I do think it's a scientific theory based on evidence that has very strong biblical theistic implications, obviously, and it refutes the current dominant worldview of a random, unguided, purposeless universe. I got a couple verses in here that I just think, these are just verses I like. I'm not calling them like proofs of intelligent design. I just think they kind of relate to it. I really like this verse right here. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you yourself will be just like him, but answer a fool according to his folly, or he will be wise in his own eyes. Answering a fool according to his folly. I think that's a lot of what this argumentation does. It says, okay, let's assume for a second that your materialistic worldview is the real one. How does it account for all the things that we see? The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. I would say, I'm not trying to rewrite scripture, but I would say it's the same thing when we look inside a microscope or, electron microscope or whatever it is. What we're seeing is the glory of God. And then this last verse, I don't know if I'm going to read this one. I'll just give you maybe a few minutes to read it. What I like is just the idea that the wisdom of Solomon, in addition to a lot of other things, was linked to this knowledge of the world around us. He spoke about plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He also spoke about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. From all nations, people came to listen to Solomon's wisdom. I just like that idea that, part of Solomon's wisdom, I mean, I wonder what he was saying. Like he didn't have any of this information that we have. I don't think, I don't think he knew about ATP synthase, but he clearly knew a lot about the natural world around him. And then finally, this is just kind of a feel good story that I like. This guy, Gunter Beckley, He was a curator of the Museum of Natural History in Stuttgart, Germany. And in 2009 was kind of a big date for Darwinists because it was the 200th birthday of Darwin, 200th anniversary of his birth. And it happened to be the 150th anniversary of The Origin of the Species, which came out in 1859. And so everybody was making a really big deal about this. And this guy was given the job of creating the display. And one of the things he did is he created this little scale here, and he put all these books that were on like intelligent design and creationism over here, and he put Darwin's Origin of the Species on here, and you can see that the scale is like tipped in the the direction of Darwin's book. And what happened though is this guy he actually read the intelligent design books, and he found out that the authors of these books and what they were saying was totally different than the ways that they were portrayed to him in science. This guy's a PhD. He discovered like 11 different paleontological dragonflies. They're named after him. He's a huge guy in the paleontology community. He read those books. He found them to be very compelling. In 2015, he actually declared his... that he was accepting the intelligent design thesis, and he was not a Christian at all, but he ultimately gave his life to Christ, and it's a great story. I appreciate you listening to me. Sorry to get choked up at the end. I knew I shouldn't have put his picture smiling because he seems so happy there, and it touches me. So anyways... thank you for listening, and I look forward to the Q&A.
I'll try not to look at the picture because I don't want to get choked up either. But